Working Cows Podcast, episode 106.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. Really excited about this episode with you guys. We are going to talk to Alex, as we're going to call him today, about his history with agriculture, and really just found a gem of a guest here who is really uniquely qualified to talk about what he sees going on in agriculture in China, and what he and his perspective, which is informed in large part by his history with a background of attending high school in the United States in the Boston area, and then attending a very well-known entrepreneurial college in Boston called Babson College. Very just interesting guy with an interesting history, young guy who's doing some unique things in China in a very difficult and trying environment. And we are going to have a very interesting show notes page at workingcows.net/106, workingcows.net/106. There will essentially be a photo essay showing you some of what's going on in the industry in China, and then some of what Alex is doing to challenge paradigms of the Chinese agriculture and beef industry specifically, that is really in its infancy. So I'm really excited to talk to Alex today, and I would encourage you to check out the show notes page at workingcows.net/106. Alex, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Hello.
So I really am fascinated by the history of cattle in China. I'm fascinated by almost every aspect of your life and just getting to understand it because it's so new to me. But where I'd like to start is kind of how have cattle traditionally been used in China, and what kind of cattle exists in China?
Sure. Well, in general, cattle has been a draft power animal for China, because especially in southern China, where we don't have a lot of pasture for horses, which you would in more temperate region. In China, we mainly cultivate rice in rice paddy, which is very wet. And we need this kind of short and heavy animal to do the draft power. So over the years, people have used cattle for draft power to plow the field and prepare for rice cultivation. So these cattle, they graze off the side fields, and in the winter, they live off rice straws. And for about 1,000 years, beef is really a forbidden food controlled by the state, because the state doesn't want people killing the production animal to sacrifice the production of crops. Mm-hmm. So there's practically no effort to select cattle for beef in particular until very recently. And we're talking about until the 80s to 90s. Mm. And even now, in most of the smaller mountainous regions where cattle production is not big, people still raise the traditional draft cows that has been raised for thousands of years. And the genetics have not been contaminated with the European breeds or English breeds. Mm. So this is the cattle we have. Mm.
And you say that they were only starting to use these breeds in the 80s and 90s. Did they import European breeds mostly when they started to think about beef for human consumption?
Yes, and in one particular breed, which is hugely influential in production, it's Simmental. And it's due to the fact that in the very beginning, it was a dual-purpose breed. And in the 70s and 80s, there was also a need for milk production. So that's why Simmental was selected. And ever since then, the skin, the coat pattern has been in farmers' mind that this is the breed and this is the kind of beef animal.
And I got connected with you through Johann Zietzmann's texting group. And he, if you spend any time in there at all, you'll see lots of very fat cattle, and they will be unapologetic about how much they enjoy and select for fat cattle. And I think I saw a picture that you posted in there recently of a very tall and skinny. Was that it looked like a Hereford, but maybe it was a Simmental that had been crossed with something else. Bull, I think, that was in a show ring or in a sale ring.
Yes. The history of buying and selling cattle has not changed for thousands of years until like these past few years. We China held its second auction of sire bulls this year, and there was the picture of that highest bid. And stud business is just getting started in China, which is amazing to hear that so that's the bull that has the highest bid this year.
And where do they seem to be learning from this? They're just getting started in the sire business. Where do they seem to be taking their information from and learning about how to raise and sell sires?
Well, it's a combination of American style and European style, in particular French, for some reason, has a huge influence in the development of cattle genetics in China. And Australia and Canada, they have the influence on cattle nutrition in China's cattle history, which is odd to me. but it's just how it is in this industry here.
Can you tell me a little bit about the climate and some of those things that you are dealing with there in China?
Yes, I am located at the southern tip of China, and we have a very humid and high heat index environment. So, for example, today, even after a typhoon, and in America it's called hurricane. And we still have a heat index of more than 120 Fahrenheit. And so this is a regular phenomenon from May all the way to early October. We get this high heat index. So it's very hot and humid for European breed, which weighs like 1,000 pounds or more. And the humidity, we have people that keep the cross, indigenous cattle and Simmental cross here, they just don't do well. They have pneumonia like constantly. So the humidity is what really kills the other breeds here. And they're just on antibiotics all the time. when they're getting finished. And also in our kind of environment, we don't have that kind of open prairie. What we have is hills and mountains, and cattle need to be able to climb up and down these steep hills. We have a lot of hills slope more than 45 degrees, and cattle weighs more than 1,000 pounds are just going to fall down. So what we have instead is small ones, and they can't weigh a lot. So we usually have around 600 to 800 pounds animal maximum. I know that because if you have a fat guy, you know, an obese guy who, you know, when you have more than 100 pounds, like 150 pounds on one foot, and you step on those fields, you're going to sink down because, the kind of soil we have here, they absorb water like sponge and it never dries out. And it's clay, but the kind of clay that you will fall down. And sometimes it's really deep. Like once you stick, once you got stuck, it's like, at least a foot, if not more. And, this cattle can easily get hurt if it's too big. And, you know, it's these two factors, the heat index, humidity, and the terrain that really determine the kind of cattle we have.
Yeah. And so can you tell me about what you are seeing and what you're seeing as the opportunity to develop cattle that are profitable, that you can raise profitably, and that will produce beef in your area?
Well, the current cattle production in southern part of China, the trend is building these huge barns and keeping all these animals inside, even cows, producing cows, cow-calf pairs. And one of the biggest reasons for this is nobody has any large parcel of land for these cattle to be roaming around, never mind having enough forage for them to graze. There's a very unique situation in this southern part of China is the trend of urbanization. So people are moving away from these deep mountains, and what they leave is what they left behind is all this vacant land, and and large parcels of mountains for cattle to roam around and forage. And so with this combination of factors of barns and people moving away, there's a great opportunity for the kind of cattle that doesn't need any housing and can survive out in the wild on their own, much like the ranchers in Sierra Nevada. So this is the and in addition, capital, the economy is slowing down worldwide and in China, and the capital is looking for ways to go into neither real estate nor the stock market is a great option. So there are people who are lining up their money to get into this cattle business, but they don't know how, and they have a lot of money So there's a need for a kind of cattle that doesn't need much care. They don't need to stay indoor, and they will be immediately productive upon buying them. Hmm. And that's the kind of cattle I am developing. Mm-hmm. And with this market, it's huge. And we are talking about an unprecedented herd number. But the problem is there isn't this kind of cattle around. If you buy European breed crosses, they wouldn't do very well. Mm-hmm. They will be in body condition 2, maximum 3. Mm. When you leave them alone, and those cows, they cost a lot. They just cost a lot, and the return on capital on them would just not be great even if you get the winning rate, in the 80%, which nobody does with Simmental in China. Wow. Nobody. So with us, we get 100% winning rate. Mm-hmm. with that cattle on forage alone. Mm-hmm. All those advantages. This cattle, they can survive on their own without much help all year round. Hmm. All year round in the mountain. This is the kind of market I am after, and the capital is lining up. Hmm. But there isn't the kind of cattle for them to invest in.
Hmm. Very neat. And as I was just listening to you talk there, I looked it up, and the Tropic of Cancer, which crosses, the northern part of Africa, it also clips the southern edge of China, just to give kind of people an idea of the climate that you're dealing with in relation to other parts of the world that they might be more familiar with. So I think in the West, we don't think about that being the reality in China, but it does span quite a bit of land north to south, and so there is a big variation, and it sounds like you're more in that almost tropical part of southern China.
Yes, the southern tip, southernmost tip.
Right. Near Laos? Yes. Or Laos?
No, actually, it's the, let me see, southeastern tip.
Okay. So you're near the ocean.
Yes.
Okay.
We are actually on the edge of the ocean. Hmm. We're like 40 miles away from the ocean.
Okay. Sure. And so have you been able to find the cattle that will work in your environment, and what are you doing to expand a herd of cattle that will perform well in your environment?
Yes. What I have been doing with my expansion since the beginning of the year is to buy, as per Johan's advice, to buy as many heifers or young cows as I can from the local community. And that's exactly what I did. And because I don't have the number to increase the pool for my bull to have enough offspring, so I have to buy whatever is on offer. And these cows, they come in this style. It's like you get you get all kinds of breeds. The variability is like English breeds to European breeds to those Creole breeds. Mm. It's just everything. So some of them are really bad, and they give birth. Well, one of the common commonalities between them is the ease of calving. And they're winning. they will give you a calf a year, like for sure, like 100%. And some of them will calf before 24 months old, and some of them are not. But mostly, well, if not all, they will calf heifers calf before 30 months old. And one thing I'm working on to getting them better drastically with one generation is the meat bone ratio. Because nobody has been selecting this cattle for meat. And so there isn't a emphasis on selecting meat animal, like full package animal. So, you know, some cattle, they will get pregnant, but their body condition is just not at the point you like. So this also amazes me, because some of these cows, they're skinny, but they get pregnant. So this is something, you know, you don't learn from learning American style cattle ranging. But this is the good trait we have in our indigenous breed. But you know, something I'm working on is getting them to be the maximum weight, well, maximum frame, maximum weight, and maximum milk for my environment. Mm-hmm. And so this is what I'm working on with this bull and my best cow. So it's very, decisions are very easily made when you have a small herd, mm-hmm. like I do. Mm-hmm. You just pick out the bull and pick out the best cow, and their progeny, their bull calf will be the next bull. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's that easy. So, you know, this is what I'm working on for my first generation.
Sure.
And as soon as I get enough cows, so as soon as I reach my desired herd size for cows, I will start culling the ones that do not have the genetics of my current bull. Mm-hmm. So at the end, every head of cattle in my herd will have the genetic of this bull. And this is the first step to getting uniformity of some sort in the herd. And there's not much worry about inbreeding in our kind of herd, because individual genetics just vary so mm-hmm. much. Unlike individual variability within a herd, which for how many generations you would count, they are related somehow.
Right.
But not in this kind of indigenous breed. They might go far back, very far back, in their relationship, in terms of genetics. So this is another difference. That advantage I'm working with.
Can you tell me about some of the like yearly rainfall and moisture? Does it come only during certain times of the year? Do you get rain throughout the whole year? Are you dealing with any kind of snow, anything like that?
We don't have snow, definitely. We are like Central Florida, but even warmer. Mm-hmm. But we're not like Southern Florida. We're definitely not Miami. Mm. In terms of the kind of rainfall pattern. So in America, most of America had a kind of wet winter / spring. In China, we have, most of China has this monsoon season where rain follows the heat. So it's great for agriculture. you know, we never get drought. Well, most of the time, usually you don't expect a drought in the summer growing season. And that's what we have. When it's hot, we get a lot of rain. When it's cold, we don't get rain. And so in the winter, in my farm, we rarely, like, it's a record to go under 45 degrees in the winter. So we, in the winter, we are working with the nice climate, you know, in the 60s, 70s. So our cattle gain weight in winter because it's comfortable.
Sure.
And there is rain, but not, like flooding rain. So it never dries out. The field never dries out, even during winter. Even if it doesn't rain for a month, it's still wet. We hate water here. We get too much. Mm-hmm. So, in terms of summer is the greatest challenge for us. Well, humidity is the number one. And the second is, typhoon, hurricane. So in the past, typhoon we had, even though it was a small one, like, on scale, we still got, I think 200 milliliter, 200 millimeter of rain. And I can't translate to inches, for that.
I'll get it.
it was a lot. Okay. It was a lot.
Almost eight inches of rain.
Yes.
So
yes, in one rain event,
right?
And in the span of less than 24 hours.
Wow.
And so this and we get that at least once a year. And so just to give you another anecdote, in this year since April, we have been growing vegetable without watering. That's how much rain we get.
Yeah.
So it rains like almost every day or every other day. And temperature here, it doesn't get to, you know, 110 degrees, but even with 90 degrees, yeah, 100 degrees, humidity missing in, it's like 140, 150.
Right.
And I don't give my cows shades. And in practice, it looks like they don't need it. When it gets super hot, like 1 p.m., they just lay down. And because they are not obese, they are not super huge, they can dissipate the heat a lot more effectively. Compared to larger animals. So this is the kind of climate we're working on. It's not bad, but it's not terribly wonderful.
So could you tell me some of, like, what kind of grass are you growing? I think in Johann Zietzmann's texting group, it would be called low octane grass, I would imagine. Is that the kind of grass you're growing?
Yes, I have not been able to establish much pasture. So I've been relying on native grass. The native grass, it's not that nutritious, whether in terms of energy or digestibility or protein. But if I am developing the kind of cattle that will thrive in the wild, this is what they're going to get. And this is what I intend to give them, to to make them to be able to thrive even in other environment where they don't have established pasture. They're just going to rely on whatever forage they have available. And I have been trying to convert my lot of mountains, because our mountains, like for, we have 160 acres of mountains, and they are all like 99% covered with ferns and noxious ferns. So I have been making all kinds of efforts to convert these ferns into something that the cattle can eat. And I have been doing some experiments with some trees, and not the leguminous trees that that have been discussed about in the group, but just like forage, just regular forage that cattle will eat their leaves. And what I'm trying to do is to establish this kind of trees, just like you would with timber harvesting. So we have a lot of timber harvesting operations around here. So they will plant seedlings in rows, and I think that's what I'm going to do. Come in the spring of 2020 to plant seedlings in rows, just like you would with timber, and then just cut them at the height of the cows, so they will graze the leaves, and that's the plan for spring, just to increase my forage availability. And on the forage side, since we really don't have a lot of pasture, we have been making our assumption on the operating cost on feeding our cattle silage we buy outside. So we have this fresh corn, this field outside, like an hour away from us here. And it's in the thousands of acres of this kind of production, supplying to the city fresh corns. And corn can be grown year round here, and with fresh corns, I think the growing season is like 3 months. 2.5 months to 3 months. So there's availability of corn stalks silage, like green corn stalk silage for us. And we did the calculation. We will still be making a profit even if we feed on this kind of forage all year round. So that's our feed. So we can, in theory, expand to a greater size than what we have land available for grazing.
Very, very cool. Really exciting. So can you tell me about some of your grazing practices to take advantage of the grasses you do have, and to be a little bit cautious about the noxious ferns that you're dealing with?
Yes. The noxious ferns, one of the great things about this is about indigenous breed is they will not touch it. They will just not touch those ferns. Even if you force them to, they will not. And so we do have about, I would say, like 20 acres of flat fields that villagers used to cultivate rice. And it's abandoned, so it's now green grass. And so what we have done is ultra high density grazing. And so we don't have a large herd. We have like 30 animals for now. And we've moved them 3 to 4 times a day and in very small paddocks. And we haven't been supplying them with other protein source for about 3 months now. And because they were getting fat coming harvest season. So I didn't want to want them to get overfed. They fed enough very easily. They do. So I'm limiting forage for now. Coming into calving season, they're just overfed, only on grass and not very nutritious grass. So very small paddock and ultra high density, and we have seen the grass production tripled every time the recover. We go back to recovery. So I think we are on our third run of the grazing, and though we, you know, in our climate, we only rest those fields for like 45 days maximum, and the production tripled for the past two times. And we have seen the result is just amazing because the field has never been fertilized. Well, like for 40 years, not fertilized. And now you have all those manure and urine, and that's like fertilizer on supercharge. So the production, when we first started it, the grass could only grow to angle height. Now when we go back 45 days, it's like waistline. It's to our east. And it's the difference is startled. And I only wish more people would come here and watch it. But on the other point, because we don't have a lot of grazing land, I only do this not to, well, only for my own benefit, because most people who raise cattle do not have their own land for cattle to graze on. They would just go on the mountain and find whatever there's forage for.
Sure. That's amazing. Are you seeing some new species of grasses coming in behind those cows in the recovery period?
Oh, definitely. I was just telling my mom about that. The grass, well, the surprisingly, well, the first time we went around, and I can show you pictures about it. We completely destroyed the field. Like you cannot see anything. It's like the field was destroyed. Because I intentionally put these cows in for extra long time, so they would really destroy the field and for new grasses to grow, and it did. So before we did that, it was the kind of grass that's low growing and very slow growing, and the palatability was not good, and I'm pretty sure the nutrient was not good. And the second time, well, during the recovery period, I started noticing, well, different kind of grasses started growing. The kind of broad leaf, you know, good palatable kind of grass. And the difference is just one time. One time of ultra high density grazing, you do it. You change the field, and now the field has been changed. Wow. These grasses that grow, they are palatable. They are the higher yield, and it's just amazing. The result is just amazing.
I would really love to get some of those pictures from you. And if I can get pictures from you, I would share them on the show notes page for today, which will be workingcows.net/106. workingcows.net/106 would be the show notes page for today. And I would love to share some of those pictures if I can get them from you.
Sure. No problem.
Alex, I really appreciate your time today, and I would love to have another conversation with you in the future about kind of how your experiment with planting trees and grazing cows through there is going.
No problem. You're always welcome.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for your time today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Great stuff there with Alex. Really excited about that episode and excited about a potential future relationship there to continue. Just hearing from him and his perspective, and really an interesting, and as I said in the intro, uniquely qualified to talk about these issues. So another great episode coming up next week. Really excited to welcome Ricky Kremers on. We're talking to her about her experience with instinctive migratory grazing, and we've talked to Bob Kinford about that. So just a fair warning, if you want to go back and check out the episodes with Bob Kinford, again, the photo essay that's going to be there today, workingcows.net/106, from Alex and his perspective on Chinese agriculture will be very much worth your time. But also there will be links to my previous episodes that both kind of touch on the ideas of instinctive migratory grazing with Bob Kinford. And you can check those out. They'll be linked at the show notes page as well, workingcows.net/106, to prepare yourself for next week's episode with Ricky Kremers. Very good episode on instinctive migratory grazing. Really look forward to getting that to you guys as soon as possible for next week's episode of the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.